Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice. Today's topic is the good, the bad, and the ugly. And you'll see what we're going to talk about here in a moment. But before we get too deep into it, I would like to introduce you to your host, Mona Shaw. Mona, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. And hello, everybody.
So I know we've got a great topic lined up, the good, the bad, the ugly, and I'm still keeping it kind of vague. I know we're going to be talking about due diligence and what that really means, but I realize that we have a special guest joining us today. Would you like to introduce him?
Yes, we're going to be talking a lot more than due diligence. We've got some fun stuff as well that a lot of people would like to hear. And we are delighted today to have the infamous, Michael Gibson. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Mona. Thanks so much for inviting me on.
And for any of those people who have not yet heard of Michael's name, Michael's the Managing Director of US Advisors, and that's a registered investment advisor. And he's also head of the EB5 projects. And of course, Michael has been around with EB5 projects since the inception. He has a lot to say about a lot of projects and what's going on.
So it sounds like the perfect person to have on and really dive into this.
Right.
So Michael, Mona and I know you, but the person listening right now may not. So Mona's obviously given a brief introduction, but if you could take that, expand on it, and tell us some more about yourself.
Great. I appreciate that, Mark. So yeah, I came from a background working for a number of years with Citicorp Investment Bank, where I was working offshore, mostly in emerging markets. We were financing large-scale infrastructure investment projects, so roads, buildings, hospitals, military bases, things of that nature. I came back to the United States after 9/11, and I was approached by an immigration attorney who asked for my advice regarding projects that were in the market at the time, and they wanted to get a risk analysis to see which of these projects would be the least risky and have the highest chance for obtaining both the immigration objectives as well as the investment objectives. So I, at that time, this was early 2007, I did an analysis. There were five projects in the market, and I did a review, gave that back to the attorney. She reviewed it, shared this with her client. They made a decision. And based on that, more attorneys started to ask us for my advice, and I came up with the structure for U.S. advisors. We became registered as an investment advisory firm, and from there we've been doing research and analysis on EB5 projects around the country in various industry groups for almost 8 years now.
Wow. So eight years, and it sounds like there were five projects way back then. I'd say there's probably a little bit more than five projects to consider now, right?
We can't even begin to estimate, but because USCIS does not release this information. But according to what we can observe in the market and from the number of calls that we get from both the issuers and the investors, we estimate that over 1,000 projects are in the market right now.
That sounds about right.
I can tell you you're quite correct, Michael, because there's about 800 alone registered in China. So 1,000 sounds quite right.
Okay. So obviously it's a changing landscape. It's an evolving landscape, and it's an expanding landscape. And to have you there from the beginning and join us on this show, it's great to have you on and share some of this this insight. So you mentioned before you did like a dual-pronged due diligence, both immigration and investment risk. So now let's dive deep into the topic that we have you here for. And I know Mona's already got a question lined up for you. So Mona, go for it.
Thank you, Mark. Michael, as you know, a lot of people who go into the EB-5 program, and I have to say that I do love this program. It's one of the only ways for so many people to emigrate to the United States, and in so many different categories. But of course, the at-risk element is frightening for many people who can't afford to lose their investment capital, whether it be 500 or even more. Then it is difficult with so many projects out there. And they do worry. There's a lot of press out there which love to jump on anything fraudulent. But in my opinion, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this one, there is a huge difference between a bad project and a fraudulent project. A fraudulent project is a project where somebody has a mindset that they are not going to do what they set out they would say to do, and they would not create the jobs, so they would not use the money in a certain way. Whereas a bad project is just bad business decisions. And a bad project you can perhaps catch in due diligence, not necessarily a fraudulent project. And the other point that, Michael, I would like you to give me your thoughts on is the fact that the scandals are really not that many in consideration of how many projects there are out there, and that the press do love to jump on the scandals because it's better reading.
Right. It's like a soap opera. Everybody stays tuned to the end to see what happened, you know, with the final tragedy. Yeah. And I think that you bring up a very valid point. What I would say is that we don't actually know the degree to which there has been fraud committed in the program. So let's start off with saying, yes, I agree with you. Everybody is concerned about risk and they're concerned about fraud. So what I would start off by saying is let's identify the key areas of risk that every applicant should be aware of, and really to a certain extent, their attorneys who are filing the work on their behalf. Because as you've already mentioned, the immigrant investor typically, although they may be accredited by definition, they are typically not sophisticated. So my sense is that if things go bad, as in the case of Jay Peak or South Dakota, Mamtech, any number of other projects that have failed, then the investors will be looking not so much to the developers, perhaps, for relief, but maybe also to the immigration attorneys who they were counting on to counsel them.
Right, but I could interrupt you here, Michael. I mean, South Dakota wasn't fraud. Mamtech was fraud, and Jay Peak is fraud. So there is a difference.
Well, it sounds like, if I may interject, it sounds like there is a difference. Perhaps the difference is the initial motivation. You know, fraudulent, they're going in to swindle people. The other ones, they had good intentions, but it was a bad project. But either way, the outcome is the same, and that's the investor doesn't get what they want. So, I mean, in that respect, Michael, for you and what you do, does it really matter the difference between fraudulent versus bad project, or do you still look for key indicators and that will wean out both?
Right. And that's a great point, Mark. If the end result is that the investor is denied their petition, they may face removal, and they've lost their investment, then it really doesn't matter whether it was through fraud, misrepresentation, or if it was just because it was a bad market decision. So you're right. From the investor standpoint, I don't think it really matters. However, and this may be of interest because I'm not sure how many investors are listening, but for the immigration attorneys who are counseling these investors, I think it does. Because if, as in the case of Jay Peak, Mamtech, and others, you've got all of the issues out on the West Coast with the Seattle fraud as well. And Texas, I mean, there's issues in California, all across the country. So for the immigration attorneys who may be listening, I think there is a difference, because if they did have investors in these projects, then they may be looking potentially at being involved in an action where the immigrant investor says, hey, you should have guided me, and the attorney might say it's not my job and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, if there is fraud, then potentially there could be some potential liability. And that's, I think, the point is that for everybody involved, whether it's the investor, the immigrant attorney, whoever it is, they should have done an exposure analysis or a risk analysis prior to any client investing. If they can't do it, then they should, you know, I think it's almost probably something that they should really insist that their clients engage a firm to do, to minimize their potential liability. So I would call it something where they would be acting in their client's best interest to strongly recommend, because if the client does invest without understanding all of the risks involved and something does happen, I think, again, they could claim that they were either ill-informed, misrepresented, whatever. And that's a situation where I think you're going to find a number of attorneys facing in the certainly in the J case, which you have hundreds and hundreds of investors.
Well, Michael, the couple of points on that one, because I hear this quite often, and I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. Yes, we should have a due diligence. Well, so many people come and they say, well, we don't know who to ask, who, where to go. And one of the other issues that I hear is that, well, number one, who's going to pay for the due diligence report? And the second thing is that person who's actually doing the due diligence, are they actually sort of, do they understand the industry? Are they familiar with the industry norms? How can I rely on that person's work? And if someone is going to commit a fraud like JPEEK, will due diligence really reveal that?
Sure, and those are great points. So I think it's the attorney's job to counsel their client as to what they think is their in their best interest. And that's really been the problem, is that I think a lot of immigration attorneys have simply deferred to their investor client and said, okay, that's fine, you've chosen this project, and really not guided them as to saying, do you understand, and the question should be asked, do you understand the risks of this investment or the potential issues that it may face in the course of its development, construction, and operation? And if the answers are not clear or the answers are no, then I think it's, again, all we're talking about here is liability avoidance. And I think to the extent possible, as much pushing, if you will, that they can do to have that investor get this information from whatever reliable sources, then the better position the immigration attorney would be in the case that there is a failure. And I'll give you an example. So, for instance, we have investors who come to us and say, can you help us do this investigation? And we said, the first question we ask them is, who is representing you? Who is your immigration attorney? And also we ask if they have a tax attorney. We will not engage a client that does not have legal representation. And I think if more immigration attorneys did the same, certainly the ones who had placed clients into the JPEEK and other projects that fail and projects that will fail, I think that they stand certainly in a better place simply because they insisted that their clients obtain this independent advice, simply because they're signing the subscription agreement with more knowledge. And I think to the extent that they can separate themselves from that process, the better off they'll be.
But that is an extra cost, Michael, and many clients really struggle, or don't even really struggle. There's a lot of fees that they have to pay. It's an extra cost at the time. And sometimes there isn't time. Sometimes there's a rush. Look at last year with the whole September 30th rush.
Again, think of what is the true cost. So, for instance, if they decided not to do, say, what would be a $5,000 or $10,000 due diligence study, now they face a complete loss of not only the capital invested, $500,000, plus potentially their residency in the United States for them and their family. So I would say to the immigration attorneys out there, what is that cost? And I think we're going to find out, because what's going to happen, and this is what I understand from having spoken with several JPEEK investors, is that they are extremely upset. They felt that their attorneys guided them into this project. Some may have even accepted commissions from this.
That's a big no-no straight away.
Well, yes, but, you know, as we mentioned earlier, in that particular case, the principals were actively courting immigration attorneys. You know, we were both at all of the immigration attorney conferences, and they were handing out finder fee agreements to anybody who came up to their booth. And so there were a lot of attorneys who were incentivized to collect a finder's fee in return for handing their clients over to this investment. And I think now they're actually weighing the cost. So what was the benefit for that? Well, they received $15,000, $25,000. But the potential liability, again, I want to stress, in the case of an investor who simply just lost the principal, that's $500,000 plus the $50,000 subscription, plus removal from the United States, you know, involving selling the house and so on and so forth. You know, I don't even know where that tops out at, $1 million, $1 million plus, perhaps treble damages if they feel the attorney misrepresented to them. So I think if you calculate those costs, which really have not been taken into account by anybody in the industry yet, simply because, as far as I know, no investors have sued their attorney. I think if you take into those costs, then I think looking at a $5,000 or $10,000 upfront fee prior to the subscription would be relatively insignificant.
Well, what if the actual due diligence report isn't reliable? I mean, how would a client feel in that respect? Or what if the project was already approved by USCIS, had approved 526s? A lot of times that is a due diligence test alone.
Well, to a certain extent, remember, there's two conditions that have to be met. One is the immigration, and yes, the second is the return of capital. So I think where we're going to find most of the issues going forward is not so much on the immigration side. Most 526s and 829s get approved. In fact, probably over 80%. So you're looking at 4 in 5 who are going to get the immigration petitions approved. That's really not the issue. The issue is loss of capital. And if that loss of capital occurred and the immigrant or their attorneys, the litigators, can prove that there was fraud or misrepresentation, then I think at that point, it becomes a different story. And the one, you know, the funny thing is we speak to a number of investors who've already lost money in a number of different projects. They're very upset and they want to sue everybody. And the first people that they want to sue is the developer. And we say, why? What's the point? You know, look in any example that you wish. The developers, the money's already gone.
So it sounds like, to your point at the top of the show, you mentioned there's really two types of risk you look for. One is immigration risk, and the other one is investment risk. And as Mona indicated, there are projects that already have successful approved 526 petitions. And what you're saying is, Michael, that yes, okay, so it's clear that one hurdle, but there's also that return on investment. And it sounds like people could get their EB-5 green card status, perhaps, but lose their money. And that would make some people sad. Am I correct in understanding that? Could that happen?
Right. And I think it's to the degree that they lose. So, for instance, if they were to lose $50,000 or perhaps even $100,000, I don't think it would be a significant issue. I think most immigrant investors could live with that. I think where they get upset is in cases where they have a near complete loss of principal, as in the case of the South Dakota beef packing plant, or in the case of what we're going to see with Jay, and there's several other projects which have lost all of the principal invested. So I think in those cases, they're going to look to see, was this a market event? Was it simply because it was a bad decision and the market moved against them? For instance, when I was at Citibank, we had a number of different parameters that we looked at when doing our risk exposure analysis. Only one of those was commercial or market risk. We had a number of other ones. We had natural or environmental. If you built a hotel, for instance, in Los Angeles, right on the epicenter of a fault zone, and there was an earthquake, question would be, would you ever receive a return on that? It would depend. So that's a natural or environmental effect, and that has nothing. The developer could have done anything about that. There's credit exposure risk. There's
Michael, if I may, just let me ask you directly. What are some of the things that you look for in a project to clear some of these hurdles for immigration and investment? Is there like a checklist or maybe a top three things you look for? What do you look for in a project that, say, perhaps immigration attorneys, even Mona, who's done many EB-5 cases, may not do in the course of their, you know, immigration consult?
Right. No, that's a great question. So it's easy. We have a long checklist of things that we look for, but I would say for the layperson out there, the very, very first and easy question to ask is there a need in the market for this? And, you know, that's something that a lot of people can do on their own. You can say, for instance, a hotel development. So we see a number of hotel projects come And the first thing we look at is in the business projections, what are they claiming that they're going to be able to produce in terms of revenue? So we look at their claims for ADR and RevPAR, and then we simply go to Priceline or Expedia and we do a market comparison. Now, it's not perfect, but I mean, it's a pretty good idea.
Well, need in the market is actually an excellent point, Michael. But I often see, and we do have a lot of examples even in our office, that rural projects versus urban projects are vastly different, especially in the viability and especially in the ability to pay back. Do you have a comment on that?
We don't really focus as much on the geographic location of the projects. We really focus on the commercial viability. So whether it's in the center of a downtown urban MSA or whether it's in the middle of a cornfield, both can be very profitable. The key point we are looking for is profitability. And I think that's what a lot of the promotions really don't get into is how are they going to make money? We see their projections, but how realistic are those projections? And the first thing I would say is that from our experience, most regional center and project projections are way out of line. They are not even close to being consistent with the market. And I think that's the one takeaway I would say is that it doesn't matter whether it's in a rural or urban area. The key is profitability. If they can't be profitable, then they will not hire people and they certainly will not be able to repay investors. And I should also mention, it really depends on the timeline for that profitability. So one of the concerns that we have right now is the large number of very large scale projects, which are going to take 5 or 10 years or longer to develop, and they will not return any cash flow or revenue for, who knows, 5, 10, maybe longer years. And I think that is very discouraging for an investor. I just see a trend in the market to going to larger and larger scale projects in which the financial return is uncertain at best, and really the exit strategy is based mostly on projections, which we don't find to be reliable.
Yeah, I happen to agree, but majority of people do actually prefer smaller to mid-sized projects. And yes, of course, the glamour projects are still there and they do still attract a lot of people. But the title of, I should say at this point, Mark, the title of this podcast is The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And of course, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the bad and the ugly. And that's hence the press love to pick up on that. But there are many projects out there which do come in the category of good. They have paid back. They have done some good to the world, to the United States, to their community. Don't you agree, Michael?
Right. And I do want to agree with you that this program, as it was designed by Congress, is a fantastic program. It brings much needed capital in the United States. It does create tens of thousands, if not tens of thousands of jobs, both directly and indirectly. So on those points, we agree. But you know, honestly, it's good, but I think it's mostly good for the developers and for the general partners and the regional centers, and of course for the immigration agents who make a lot of money in commissions. I have almost hardly ever seen an investment that is good for the investor, just simply because of the extreme amount of risk that they take, given the very low rate of return. So an average return on these, on 90% of these projects is around 1% or less, yet they are carrying all, you look at the risk they're taking, they are subordinate to any senior commercial loan. They are the longest ones in it for 5 to 7 years, and they're the last ones typically to be repaid in the event that there is an exit. So yes, it's great for the United States, it's great for the regional centers, it's great for the promoters, and certainly in the case, as you saw in JPEAK, the only people making money were the developers. So in that respect, it's fantastic. For the investors, very few and far between these projects, which actually generate a real market-based rate of return and a successful exit.
Well, Michael, they're not expecting a large rate of return. It's almost understood that as long as they get a return of the capital, they really don't mind if they don't have more than 1% or 2%. And that's quite standard to in most projects that I've seen. And there are many projects who have, the investors have had a wonderful experience. I'm not saying that what you're saying is wrong. I'm just saying it doesn't count for all projects. And I can tell you there are developers who do listen to this podcast as well as legislators. So we do want to make sure we have a balanced view of everything.
Well, and I'll just bring in something from an earlier episode. Mona, I remember talking with you and Rebecca, and you suggested that the investor, an EB-5 investor, make the investment into EB-5 and then use the rest of their capital to make, well, what Michael is talking about, you know, market investments, things that have a higher rate of return. But for your immigration investment, let's make sure that your immigration paperwork is safe and secure, where other ones may, you know, cut jobs to increase shareholder value. Well, if you cut jobs on an EB-5 investment, you know, there goes your immigration status. Yeah, and I realize there's a lot of gray area here, which is why this is the good, the bad, the ugly. And I want to go back to an earlier point. So we talked about need for the market. There's obviously some good projects. Michael, are there two other things that that you would look for that may be exhibited in a good project?
Honestly, I would say it really depends. Every project is different. What really we're looking for is the projects that are going to be commercially viable as soon as possible. That would be probably the one area other than profitability we focus on. So these long development timelines, which we see typically in large-scale urban environments, New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle, Miami, we've got a number of projects which are, the timelines are extending beyond 5 years just to develop. So then you have to be commercially viable and then stabilize. So you're looking at timelines that are extremely, I think, unworkable for EB-5. So what we would look for is, number one, how much can they return to their investors in terms of profitability? And number two is, how soon can they do that? So those are the two things that we really focus on, because unfortunately, the developers are, I think, honestly taking advantage of the deference that the investors are willing to give up in return. Okay. For making that investment.
One caveat to that, though, Michael, one issue is here is that the amount we're looking at is $500,000. I know it's a lot of money for a lot of people, but in the grand scheme of things, $500,000 in comparison to all the other immigrant investment programs is very low. United Kingdom being $2 million, Australia being around $4 million. You know, $500,000 isn't that much in, as I say, in the grand scheme of things.
No, I agree. I just think you have a decision. Investors have an option. They can either make an investment into a project that will become profitable soon, or they can make an investment into a project that may never become profitable, and it may take years and years for them to realize that fact. So based on that, our preference would be that they invest into a project that looks, certainly based on a market analysis, that it will become profitable as quickly as possible. So it will create all the jobs they have been promising to create.
Yeah, excellent advice.
So that's an example of a good project. You know, one that has, there's a need for a market. It shows promising ability to have a high rate of return, as well as, you know, speed. It will return that investment relatively quickly into the project itself. So using that framework, what's a bad project and what's an ugly project? And I'm guessing ugly is probably fraudulent with all those downstream things. But I don't want to lead you on. So go for it, Michael. What would be an example of a bad project?
Right. And I'll be honest, we don't really use so much the terms good and bad internally. We use strong and weak. So what we're looking for are projects with strong financials, strong market conditions, you know, the strong appetite.
So let's look at weak.
Okay, so the weak ones, well, as I mentioned before, unfortunately, there's a lot of large-scale development projects which just I don't think are ever going to become viable. And they're being heavily marketed, certainly in China, India, and other places. And these projects probably, if they are able to do everything that they say they can do in terms of getting their permits, raising all of the capital, not only from EB-5, which is typically in excess of $100 million, but raising the other forms of capital and all of the things align, the stars and moons align, then they might, the investor at the end of 5 to 7 years might get their money back and they might get 0.25%. I would call those very weak projects, where the investors really are at substantial risk that none of these things actually happen and they're left holding the bag.
Well, as I can say, SEC and the USCIS are really stepping up, and all of this boils down to what they can and cannot do and what Congress allows them to do. And with the new integrity bill hopefully coming in this year, we are looking to see increased powers given to both the SEC and USCIS and increased oversight. For example, as you know, Michael, they've already started, I believe, USCIS are doing site visits of projects.
Yeah, USCIS is a disaster. I honestly don't think we don't need an integrity bill. I think a lot of the fraud that is being perpetrated in the market is a direct result of the inaction of USCIS to release information, divulge information on who the principals are behind these offerings, how much they're raising, and which projects they're approving and which they're denying. I mean, there is a complete lack of transparency from the agency which monitors this. In the state of almost any state in the nation, if you want to practice as a carpenter, a plumber, as an investment advisor, you need to be registered. And this information is publicly available. People can look and do broker check and do all sorts of checks to see if you are a person in good standing. However, we know absolutely nothing about who is behind these regional centers and who's behind the project. So,
well, to be fair, Michael, all of this stuff is coming out in the integrity bill. The integrity bill is making sure that anyone with convictions, for example, cannot run a regional center or be part of an NCE.
Right, but we don't need a bill for that. USCIS tomorrow, without a bill, could release this information. For instance, they used to have it on their site. They used to name the principals behind the regional centers. And many of these were fronts. They were an attorney. There was an attorney representing. And as we know, I mean, there is a lot of third-party involvement in the program. We don't know who the actual owners is. My point is this. Tomorrow, without a bill, the USCIS could release all of the I-924As, which would detail all of the information about who has raised capital, how much capital they've raised, how many jobs have been created. And none of this requires a bill. And this transparency would be welcomed by everybody in the program, I believe, except for those who are committing fraud. So, again, my point is that the incidence or the potential for fraud would be reduced overnight if USCIS was a transparent agency and they would release information on which projects they approve and who's behind them.
I think a lot has got to do with the amount of manpower that is required to do all of that. And again, the integrity bill is hopefully will be passed this year and is going to cover all of that. So we are hoping that there will be more transparency and more security for investors moving forward.
I agree. But what I'm saying, the release of the I-924As, those are PDFs, that would take 5 minutes for them to release.
I believe that there are, I've heard that there is something going out allowing that to happen.
So integrity bill, possibly later down the road, we have EB-5 the way it is now. Michael, I know you do diligence on EB-5 projects now. Do you foresee yourself still doing due diligence and the need for due diligence after the integrity bill is passed?
I don't even know if a bill will be passed. My sense is that there is a schism in Congress between senators who represent large-scale urban developers and those who represent the rest of the community, including flyover rural states. So we may never get a bill. If we do, it may be watered down. So as I mentioned before, USCIS on its own could do a lot to increase transparency without any sort of a measure by Congress, which may or may not come. To answer your question, yes. We know one thing is for sure. The program, the EB-5 direct program, will exist on October 1st, no matter what happens. The regional center program may or may not exist, or it may be changed. The minimum investment amounts may increase. There may be more oversight, site visits, audits, so on. All of that may or may not happen, but one thing is for sure. The direct program in the United States will continue. That is law. What is not certain is the sunset provision on the regional center. And so to that extent, if that were to go away tomorrow, it wouldn't really affect our business because people still need information and research and analysis to determine which of the direct projects would be best and most suitable for them.
So it sounds like you're obviously a fan of, regardless of what the legislation is going to do, that investors should take the means and the power within themselves to get due diligence on something that matters to them. And in this case, it would be an EB-5 investment to make sure they get their return on investment as well as their immigration status.
Right. I think without proper information, that investors make very poor decisions, and we know this is true.
I make poor decisions every day, sometimes with lots of information.
We all do, but fortunately, because of the internet and because of other sources, we can use information to make better choices. My point is mostly for the listening audience, if they are immigration attorneys, is that I think there is exposure for you, and you can use your limitation of liability as a shield. I think that's going to be pierced. If there is a case where investors did get into a project, regardless of your actions, where they will sue you, and you know you can be sued for anything, whether they're successful or not. My feeling is that the more they insulate themselves from the actual investment decision, the better off they'll be, regardless of the outcome.
So it sounds like in the EB-5 program, there is the good and the bad, as Michael calls it, the strong and the weak, and in some cases, the ugly. And certainly you want to protect yourselves from the ugly cases as well as the bad ones as well. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mark and Mona, for inviting me.
You're very welcome, Michael, and I'm sure we would have lots more to discuss in the future once that integrity bill gets passed.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I would like to thank our special guest, Michael Gibson, for coming on and really sharing us his information and insight on EB-5 due diligence and why it's important. Be sure to catch our next episode. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.